Chapter 20. Like Catherine Graham, Dorothy Kilgallen believed strongly in the freedom of the press, and while Mark Sinclair, butler James Clement, and Charles Simpson, each a close friend, urged her to stop the investigation into JFK's death, the courageous journalist was certain the American public had a right to know what Jack Ruby had told the Warren Commission. Otherwise, she must have believed, the truth would be hidden in the shadows with no transparency. One must remember that Kilgallen, once she had access to the commission testimony, had a distinct advantage as to its importance, since she knew the substance of witnesses' testimony at the Ruby trial regarding his words and actions before and after he shot Oswald. Kilgallen could thus compare that testimony with what Ruby told the commission so as to consider whether distortions of history were in existence. Publishing Ruby's testimony for the world to read must be considered a crowning moment in a journalistic career matched by few, if any, reporters before Kilgallen's era or since. Graham may have been risking her freedom and the Post's very existence, but Kilgallen, thumbing her nose at dangerous foes, was risking her life. Regarding Kilgallen's exposure of Jack Ruby's Warren Commission testimony, Mark Sinclair stated during one of his interviews, "That's when the heat really started. That's when my phones were bugged. People started following us, Sinclair and Simpson. It wasn't very good after that. Everything was done to discredit Dorothy after she wrote about the assassinations, and to degrade her, but Dorothy wouldn't stop with the JFK assassination investigation. She had it all. She told me about this, and Charles Simpson was there too, and he knew. We knew what she was doing." He added, "She said this was the case of a lifetime, a story of a lifetime, that she would prove who assassinated the president." Summing up the risk she took, Sinclair stated, "What Dorothy did was like slapping them, the government, in the face." Interview available at thedorothykilgallenstory.org. Kilgallen even wrote a column specifically to thank thousands of readers who had expressed their opinions about her exclusive. When the official commission report was issued on September 30, 1964, Kilgallen wrote a column on the same day entitled "A Personal Reaction to the Warren Report," also released under the headline "Maybe You Don't Know" in the Journal American on September 30, 1964. It also addressed the government's attempts to learn the source of her having access to the Ruby testimony. "From what I have read, I would be inclined to believe that the FBI might be more profitably employed in probing the facts of the case rather than how I got them, which does seem a waste of time to me. At any rate, the whole thing smells a bit fishy. It's a mite too simple that a chap kills the President of the United States, escapes from that bother, kills a policeman, eventually is apprehended in a movie theater under circumstances that defy every law of police procedure, and subsequently is murdered under extraordinary circumstances. The Warren Report made a great effort to note that the FBI and the Secret Service were delinquent in their duty, and that the press media, TV, radio, and newspaper, also were responsible for the confusion that made Oswald's murder possible." Baloney. Oswald was not killed by a newspaper man. He was killed by a nightclub owner well known to the police, Jack Ruby. How could the Warren Commission pretend to forget that? Despite Kilgallen's strong words of warning that the report needed to be carefully scrutinized, that the whole thing smells a bit fishy, it appears little attention was paid to the column by the other media or anyone truly interested in the truth about the assassinations. Instead, focus was on the commission's Oswald alone verdict and nothing else, a myth that has been perpetuated to this day. To her lawyer, Mort Farber, she called the Warren Commission report laughable. Why? Because, as first disclosed in Denial of Justice, when Kilgallen read the report, Ruby's close friendship with a plethora of DPD officers, as noted at his trial, "You all know me, I'm Jack Ruby," was not included. This evidence proved Oswald's killer could move easily among the police when Oswald was being interrogated, and explained how he so easily ended up in the DPD jail basement with access to JFK's alleged assassin. In addition, Kilgallen realized many other significant facts, for the most part, had been left out of the Ruby section of the Warren Commission report, or, even worse, if they were included, discarded as insignificant, giving the appearance that the commission members had cherry-picked evidence pointing to the Oswald alone theory and it alone. An exception was crucial testimony, apparently rendered insignificant when it came time for a verdict, which included that from parking lot owner Garnet C. Hallmark, who testified during the trial that Ruby said he would be there when Oswald was transferred, a striking comment of enormous historical importance, pointing dead center toward Ruby being part of the assassination plot to kill JFK and eliminate Oswald. Regarding Hallmark, when Kilgallen read the Warren Commission report, she noticed a section indicating that Ruby went to the Nichols parking garage adjacent to the Carousel Club, where he was seen by Garnet C. Hallmark, general manager of the garage, and Tom Brown, an attendant, after leaving Dealey Plaza during the early hours of the afternoon of Saturday the 23rd, the day before he shot Oswald. Further, Kilgallen read that Brown, apparently overhearing what was said on the public phone, heard Ruby mention Chief Curry's name, while Hallmark stated that Ruby told him he was acting like a reporter when he entered the DPD basement. Hallmark further stated Ruby addressed someone at the other end of the telephone and caught portions of a conversation concerning the transfer of Oswald while remarking to the recipient of the call, "You know I'll be there." Hallmark's important account of these five words being spoken, Kilgallen knew, was even more direct than what he had testified to at Ruby's trial. But, to her dismay, it had been left out of any conclusions reached by the Warren Commission regarding Ruby when it decided Oswald's killer wasn't a part of any plot to kill JFK. On the downside, Kilgallen knew that Dallas Morning News ad salesman John Newman had confirmed at the trial that Ruby was in those offices at the exact time JFK was assassinated, all while being directly in front of or near a window facing down the street toward Dealey Plaza and the sixth floor of the book depository. Nothing about this testimony, she realized, was included in the Warren Commission report. Regarding trial testimony from Dallas Morning News reporter John Rutledge, who had noted Ruby's apparent close friendship with D.A. Henry Wade, calling him Henry, not Mr. Wade, when Ruby set up the D.A.'s telephone call on the Friday night of Oswald's news conference, Kilgallen would have noticed that there were inconsistencies in which testimony was included in the report. Rutledge had testified to the important fact that Ruby said, "I am helping out all these fellows," referring to other reporters, and that he had a notebook and pencil in his hand, the working tools of a reporter. This testimony, which connected with Officer T.D. McMillan, who said Ruby had admitted he could always act like a reporter, and that he had just ducked his head and kept going when he entered the DPD jail basement, had been left out of the report. Kilgallen would also have noted Rutledge's testimony at trial that Oswald's killer had appeared on the third floor of the Dallas Police Department just before midnight on the 22nd, which was not included in the report, nor was him stating, "I saw Jack and two out-of-state reporters go around the corner where Captain Fritz's office was, and Jack was bent over like this, writing on a piece of paper, and talking to one of the reporters and pointing to something on the piece of paper. He was kind of hunched over." Overall, Kilgallen would have surmised, Rutledge had pointed to Ruby at trial as not only acting like a reporter, confirming Hallmark's testimony, but also mentioning that Ruby was bent over like this, kind of hunched over, a clear indication Ruby had infiltrated police headquarters on a floor near where Oswald was being interrogated while attempting to hide the fact that he had no business there and should have been removed. Once again, Kilgallen knew this critical evidence, that Ruby was obviously stalking Oswald, was nowhere mentioned in the commission report conclusions, ignored despite its historical importance, pointing to Ruby being part of a plot to assassinate JFK, followed by a cover-up. Today, the sixth-floor museum at Dealey Plaza in Dallas is, in effect, a distortion of history rubber stamp for the Warren Commission report, which has been discounted ad infinitum for decades. Despite the glaring omissions in the report, an accomplished and highly curious reporter such as Kilgallen would have shaken her head at Ruby's actions as he parked near the DPD building on Sunday at around 11 a.m., the day he assassinated Oswald. The report revealed, Ruby parked his car in a lot directly across the street from the Western Union office. He apparently placed his billfold in the trunk of the car, then locked the trunk, which contained approximately $1,000 in cash, and placed the trunk key in the glove compartment. He did not lock the car. Added was the information that, with this revolver, more than $2,000 in cash, and no personal identification, Ruby walked from the parking lot across the street to the Western Union office. It appears quite plausible Kilgallen would have asked herself the same question anyone who wasn't brain dead would have asked. Why did Ruby act as he did if he wasn't fulfilling his Saturday telephone promise to be there with the full intent of killing Oswald in the DPD jail basement based on the actions noted in the commission report? This did not make sense, but again, she knew this vital evidence had been ignored by the Warren Commission because, it appeared clear to her, the members had their own agenda, being a rubber stamp for Hoover's Oswald Alone proclamations. Continually astonished as she made note after note in her ever-thickening JFK assassination file, Kilgallen must have realized that the cover-up instigated by J. Edgar Hoover moments after JFK was killed and then when Ruby assassinated Oswald had now stretched to the Warren Commission. She knew the commission's findings were bogus, since so much of the testimony pointing toward a plot to kill JFK had been disregarded when the report conclusions were made public, thus denying that public the truth. On the flip side, Hoover and his cohorts in the Justice Department must have realized the discrepancies between the Ruby trial testimony and the Ruby Warren Commission testimony, but it appeared most of the press was brain dead and did not report the discrepancies either out of fear of offending Hoover or because they were simply lazy and didn't conduct a thorough investigation to compare and check the facts. To Hoover and anyone involved in the JFK assassination, Kilgallen was like rolling thunder, a serious threat requiring daily monitoring so as to discover what the dogged reporter might turn up next. Of great benefit, they knew, would be a mole in Kilgallen's camp, her inner circle, someone she trusted who could provide updates on her investigation in general and what she intended to write in her Random House book. Kilgallen's blasting of the Warren Commission report, along with her lethal columns, basically calling Hoover a liar for his shouting of the Oswald Alone theory to the world, her interview of Ruby, and her releasing Ruby's commission testimony before the official release date, had marked her for death. She just didn't realize it. Unknown to the general public and most historians through the decades since the JFK assassination is the Texas Supplemental Report on the Assassination of President John F. Kennedy and the Serious Wounding of Governor John B. Connally. Whether Kilgallen had read or was even aware of this document remains unknown. Released on October 5, 1964, shortly after the Warren Commission report, the 21-page document was written by former Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives and Texas Attorney General Wagner Carr. He served the latter post from 1963 to 1967. An opponent of segregation, he was one of the first Texas attorneys general to stand up for minority issues in the school system. Carr ran unsuccessfully for the United States Senate in 1966, and for governor in 1968, before returning to private practice. On the introductory page, Carr began, "I deem it appropriate to supplement the report of the Warren Commission with exploratory comments directed to you and my fellow Texans." At page 10, Carr repeats the same mistake as the flawed Warren Commission report when writing, 1. Lee Harvey Oswald was the assassin of President Kennedy and fired the shots that wounded Governor Connally and killed Officer J.D. Tippit. 2. The acts of Lee Harvey Oswald were not pursuant to any conspiracy, domestic or foreign, to assassinate President Kennedy. Carr added that, "I concur with the commission finding that there was no connection between Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby in the matter of the assassination," basically rubber-stamping the commission's conclusions, just as the commission had rubber-stamped J. Edgar Hoover's shouting of "Oswald alone" to the world. Obviously, just as the demonstrably incompetent or deliberately obstructive members of the Warren Commission had done, Carr paid no attention whatsoever to the testimony of sworn eyewitnesses at the Ruby trial, which clearly indicated Ruby had played a role in a conspiracy to assassinate JFK. Sadly, for the sake of truth in the historical record and for the edification of the American people, only one reporter had the courage to battle these ridiculous rulings, Dorothy May Kilgallen. The diehard journalist's obsession with solving the JFK assassination mystery led Kilgallen to becoming an increasingly competent detective of sorts. This included attempting to recreate part of what happened on November 22nd in Dealey Plaza. To do so, she relied on the Warren Commission testimony of a steam fitter named Howard Brennan. He had provided a description of an alleged shooter, permitting police to release a physical description. Brennan told police he was sitting on a concrete wall as the presidential motorcade passed through the plaza. The wall was located 100 feet from the book depository window. Brennan said he could see up into the sixth-floor window where someone was holding a rifle. Believing this to be impossible, Kilgallen had her husband Richard stand at their townhouse window on an upper floor. He held a broomstick, mirroring Oswald holding a rifle. She stood outside on East 68th Street at the same distance as Brennan described. When she returned to the townhouse, she informed Richard that her conclusion was correct. Brennan could not have seen into the window, could not have seen anyone holding a rifle. Amazingly enough, Kilgallen's Journal American columns attacking any semblance of plausibility in the Oswald alone theory, her exposure of the Jack Ruby testimony before the release of the Warren Commission report, her experiments casting doubt on testimony about Oswald as the lone shooter, and her columns and articles printing the truth about what happened on November 22, 1963, in Dallas, provided John F. Kennedy with the only thorough investigation of his death in history. By securing the true facts about what happened, she stood alone, since every government agency and every so-called expert, including authors of hundreds, if not thousands, of books about the assassination then and to date, failed to fully investigate as she had done. Such a statement is mind-boggling for sure, but true for certain when one considers Kilgallen's body of work from the moment her friend JFK died until she perished as well. That a single reporter could do so speaks to the ineptness of the Warren Commission's investigation, skewed as it was to doubling down on Hoover's Oswald Alone proclamation. On purpose, for sure, Kilgallen was never asked to testify at the commission among the 25,000 who were, if one believes the commission report, which in itself points to the futility of that report. Clearly, JFK, the President of the United States, the most powerful man in the world, did not receive the investigation his assassination deserved by those charged with that responsibility so the public could learn the truth, since Kilgallen's facts and conclusions were ignored in 1963 to 1964 and shortly thereafter, and discounted or even dismissed ever since. Similarly, Marilyn Monroe, the most beloved and iconic movie star in the world, did not receive the investigation her death deserved, a death surrounded in intrigue associated with the Kennedy family. Regarding Kilgallen's demise 3 years later, did this woman, ranking among the greatest journalists of her era and hot on the trail of the greatest murder mystery in American history, receive the investigation her death deserved after she died on November 8, 1965? Dorothy Kilgallen's activities, in addition to writing her book about the assassinations as November 1965 approached, she had, in September, eased into Lou Walters, Barbara Walters's father, Latin Quarter nightclub, located at Broadway and West 47th Street in New York City. Headliners who had appeared there included Ella Fitzgerald, Patti Page, and Milton Berle, but on this evening, Kilgallen watched singer Johnny Ray perform from a backstage perch. The following month, a newspaper strike stopped the presses in New York City. With time to spare, Kilgallen joined host Gore Vidal and guest David Susskind on the popular WPIX radio program Hotline. The subject of the JFK assassination, to her dismay, was left out of the discussion. Kilgallen's columns during this time mostly centered on entertainment issues. An example was an October 5th column entitled, "Who'll Succeed Johnny Carson?" with her speculating either Jerry Lewis or Tony Randall would take over the reins of The Tonight Show, even though Carson apparently had no intention of leaving the program. The column posted on the 27th, 12 days before she died, was a scoop with the headline, "Elvis to Star as the Midnight Cowboy?" Kilgallen wrote that director Mark Rydell had the King of Rock and Roll to play Joe Buck, with Kilgallen commenting, "Not a bad idea. Elvis might be perfect for the role." Previously, Kilgallen had mentioned Elvis getting big bucks, this time in a column with the headline, "Elvis Film Deal Cool $700,000, nearly $6 million in today's dollars." She wrote, "Elvis Presley's deal with United Artists for his Frankie and Johnny film is another of those fabulous contracts by the canny Colonel Parker. For this chore, Elvis is being paid a mere $700,000 plus 10% of the profits." Kilgallen also disclosed that Michigan's governor, George Romney, had presidential aspirations, and, showing her keeping an eye on world events while having sources no other journalist could garner, she wrote, "Small groups of communists are sneaking into the Dominican Republic from Cuba to fight with the rebel forces and make the job of U.S. and OAS troops more difficult. They're all well-armed and commando-trained." Earlier, Kilgallen had addressed the continuing saga of the controversial Vietnam War. On October 20th, part of a column stated, "The FBI has been alerted. There are even more big student demonstrations being planned at colleges and universities this year. In protest against our Vietnam policy, of course." 6 days later, the October 26th column's headline was, "Diplomats See Early Viet War End," with her editors having shortened Vietnam to Viet. She wrote, "High echelon figures in diplomacy are again deeply involved in trying to bring about a halt to the Vietnam War. Peace may come far sooner than expected, possibly early in 1966. The column did not identify the diplomats and was otherwise general in nature. When Kilgallen's hairdresser Sinclair was asked whether she had expressed a bias for or against the burgeoning American involvement in Vietnam, he replied, "Yes, she opposed American involvement,